The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues for the next half hour. I'll be reading articles principally from the Harvard Health Letter. This is the March 2024 issue of the Harvard Health Letter. And the first article is entitled The Colonoscopy Diet. What you eat before, right after, and in the days following a colonoscopy can make a difference for the procedure and your gut health. A colonoscopy reigns as the gold standard screening test to look for colorectal cancer and other bowel problems. It's an outpatient procedure that allows your doctor to peek inside your colon using a thin, flexible tube with an attached camera, inspect the colon lining, and even remove potentially cancerous growths. But the doctor's expertise isn't all that's needed to make the procedure a success. Your preparation, what you eat, and the way you clean out your gut beforehand is essential to give your doctor the best view of the colon lining. And the post-procedure diet is important for your comfort and gut health. Here is what you need to know about a colonoscopy diet. 3 days beforehand. The mission to prepare your colon for a colonoscopy starts a few days before the procedure. During this time, we advise that you eat a low-fiber diet. These foods are easy to digest and move through the colon faster than high-fiber foods. This will make colon prep easier, says Dr. Andrew T. Chan, a gastroenterologist and director of epidemiology at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital Cancer Center. Eating a low-fiber diet doesn't mean you can ditch all healthy food and reach for chips and soda instead. It means eating foods like animal protein, eggs, cheese, fish, and poultry, certain cooked vegetables, carrots, green beans, potatoes, pumpkin, yams, or zucchini, low-fiber fruits, bananas, peaches, and pears, and if your doctor says it's okay, low-fiber breads like white, sourdough, or refined wheat breads. A low-fiber diet also nixes foods like legumes, beans, lentils, and peas, whole grains, whole wheat crackers, cereals, breads, popcorn, granola, nuts, seeds, dried fruit, and high-fiber raw fruits like asparagus, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, cabbage, cauliflower, and celery. The day before the colonoscopy. Unless your doctor has prescribed the type of colonoscopy prep that's done only on the day of the procedure, the day before a colonoscopy is when you should have only clear liquids. Examples include clear broth or bouillon, black coffee, plain tea, clear juice, clear soft drinks, sports drinks, Jell-O, and popsicles. Then in the late afternoon, you take laxative pills and solutions and drink lots of fluids to clean out your colon. Avoid food or drinks that are red, blue, or purple. Just like they can temporarily stain your tongue, they can also stain the lining of your colon, which might make it hard for your doctor to examine it properly. Stay away from grape, raspberry, or cherry Jell-O or popsicles. Go for lighter colored flavors, like banana. A colonoscopy requires you to receive a powerful sedative. Most people remain conscious but are very relaxed and less likely to feel any discomfort. You also may have little memory of the procedure. Because of the sedative, you probably won't be allowed to eat or drink anything on the day of your procedure, unless your doctor has advised you to continue taking your usual prescription medications with a sip of water, or your doctor has directed you to begin the colon prep on this day. After the procedure, you'll be allowed to resume your normal diet. But should you? A sudden injection of fiber, like a bowl of black bean soup with whole wheat crackers, or chickpea pasta tossed with olive oil, with grilled asparagus might cause gas, bloating, and discomfort. Some people are able to start eating a full diet right away without discomfort, while others may require a slower introduction of their usual foods. It might be wisest to restart your normal diet gradually, over the next day or so, Dr. Chan says. With your colon cleaned out, you might wonder if you now have an opportunity to create a healthier population of gut microbes than you had before. Is it possible? The jury is still out. There's no clear evidence that you can more favorably repopulate your gut bacteria over the long term after a colonoscopy with any particular dietary change. What we do know is that your gut is home to trillions of mostly beneficial microbes, bacteria, viruses, fungi, that help digest your food and keep you healthy. These bugs fight harmful pathogens, make vitamin K and other important chemicals, affect the way medications work, influence your immune system, heart health, and cancer risk, and possibly play a role in healthy aging and longevity. We also know that what you eat can help gut microbes thrive. For the best results, feed them a fiber-rich diet that includes fruits, vegetables, legumes like beans and peas, and whole grains like quinoa, oats, whole wheat, and brown rice. These are the kind of foods found in a Mediterranean diet, which also includes lean proteins, poultry and fish, olive oil, nuts and seeds, dairy foods, and limited amounts of red wine. It's a diet that will keep your gut microbes happy and help you maintain many other aspects of good health. Now we're going to turn in the Harvard Health Letter to Ask the Doctor by Dr. Anthony Komaroff, who is the editor-in-chief of the Harvard Health Letter. The question for Dr. Komaroff: I have heart disease, and I take aspirin to reduce my risk of new heart problems. Does it matter how much aspirin I take, or whether the aspirin is a type that is enteric-coated to protect my stomach? And Dr. Komaroff answers, what we know for sure is that people who have heart disease reduce their risk of developing new heart problems by taking aspirin. So I'm glad you're taking aspirin, but the best dose, and whether the enteric-coated form is better, is uncertain. People with heart disease benefit from taking aspirin because aspirin makes the blood a bit less likely to clot and also reduces inflammation. Heart attacks typically happen because a blood clot has formed in one of the arteries of the heart, blocking the flow of blood to part of the heart muscle. Inflammation inside of a plaque deposit in the walls of the arteries makes such clots more likely to happen. Theoretically, aspirin should benefit people with heart disease, and studies definitely show that it does. However, aspirin also increases the risk of bleeding. The most common site of bleeding is the gastrointestinal tract, particularly the stomach and intestines. The enteric-coated form of aspirin was created to try to protect the stomach from bleeding. The most dangerous site of bleeding is inside the brain, a hemorrhagic stroke. Fortunately, the studies that show aspirin benefits people with heart disease also show that these benefits are greater than the risks of bleeding. So to your question, what dose of aspirin is best, and should you take an enteric-coated or uncoated aspirin pill? A 2023 study in JAMA Cardiology provides some insight. Over 10,000 people with heart disease were assigned at random to take either a regular dose aspirin, 325 milligrams, or a low dose aspirin, 81 milligrams, every day for about 2 years. While the dose was assigned at random, the study participants were allowed to choose whether they would take enteric-coated or uncoated aspirin. The study concluded that neither the dose nor the enteric coating affected either the benefit or the risk from aspirin. There was not a statistically significant difference. However, in my opinion, the study does not really settle the question. As big as it was not big enough to have the statistical power needed. Also, It would have been better if participants had been assigned at random to enteric-coated or uncoated aspirin and followed for more than 2 years. In particular, the study did observe a greater tendency for gastrointestinal bleeding in the uncoated aspirin groups. In my opinion, this study and others indicate that people with heart disease should take one low-dose enteric-coated aspirin pill a day. Like you, I have heart disease, and that's what I do. Now, the next article in the Harvard Health Letter of March 2024 is entitled Medication Disposal: How, Why to Do It Safely. Read this before tossing out or keeping old or unneeded drugs. If you're doing any spring cleaning this year, remember to look in your medicine cabinet to weed out expired or unneeded medication. Hanging on to them is risky, since outdated medicines can lose their effectiveness or even harm you. And having used medication equipment, like needles, around can hurt you and others. Fortunately, it's simple to dispose of these items safely. Candidates for disposal include any expired or unneeded prescription or over-the-counter medication, including vitamins, herbs, and other supplements, and used medication equipment. Beyond pills, hunt for liquids, ointments, lotions, patches, aerosol cans, spray bottles, droppers, and needles. It could be an expired cold remedy, an antibiotic you didn't finish, pain pills left over from surgery, or a blood pressure medication that wasn't strong enough and was discontinued. Don't keep it. You might think you'll need it one day, but you shouldn't take it if it's expired. It might not work effectively, says Joan Doyle Petrangolo, a pharmacist at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital. Once you've gathered your expired or unneeded medications, use one of the following options to dispose of them. One is take-back sites. You might hear a lot about take-back initiatives during April and October, when local law enforcement agencies team up with the Drug Enforcement Agency, or DEA, for National Prescription Drug Take-Back Day. This is coming up April 27, 2024. The option allows you to bring medications to particular drug take-back sites and drop them off for free. But pharmacies, hospitals, health departments, and law enforcement agencies often provide medication disposal kiosks that are accessible year-round. When going this route, keep at least a portion of the prescription label on the drugs so you can tell what they are, but remove or scratch out personal information. Needles are never accepted, and liquid or aerosol medication might not be. Call ahead for details. Then there are medical waste collection sites. Your city or county may allow medication disposal at the local landfill or health department. This is helpful for safely getting rid of liquid drugs, inhalers, or needles. Keep needles in a sealed plastic container. Many drug stores and local health departments offer these containers for free. If you don't have one, put the needles in an empty laundry detergent bottle or another plastic container. Call your sanitation or health department to find out what will be accepted. As a last resort, it's okay to toss medications into the trash with careful preparation. Some drug stores provide free disposal packets that come with powder you mix with water in the medication container so the drug becomes unusable and safe to throw away. Remove and shred prescription labels first. The FDA recommends that you mix your medication with unappealing substances like dirt, cat litter, or used coffee grounds. Place the mixture in a sealable plastic bag, like an empty laundry detergent bottle, and throw the bag or container in your trash. This practice may not be allowed for needles or aerosol cans, so be sure to ask your sanitation department for rules first. If you have any remaining prescription bottles or boxes, remove and shred the labels and recycle the containers if possible. And then it goes on to have a little article called Improper Disposal. You definitely do not want to dispose of unneeded or expired medications by pouring them down the drain, flushing them down the toilet, or tossing them into the trash without special preparation. That's how chemicals wind up in the soil, in the waterways, and in the groundwater. Used needles that are thrown out can poke holes in garbage bags, causing leaks and potentially hurting sanitation workers who pick up the garbage. Needles that are flushed down the toilet can get stuck in your home's plumbing or in equipment at the local water treatment plant. The FDA notes that some medications are so sought after for misuse and so potentially deadly that if none of the methods of disposal in the accompanying article are possible, you should flush the drugs. Drugs on the FDA flush list include opioids, such as any drug whose label contains the word hydrocodone, buprenorphine, fentanyl, or oxycodone, as well as certain non-opioids like diazepam rectal gel, methylphenidate patches, and drugs with the word sodium oxybate, O-X-Y-B-A-T-E. Some communities don't allow this practice. Contact your local health or sanitation department for more on medication disposal that meets all regulations. With spring coming, here's a useful article, again from the Harvard Health Letter. It's entitled, Be Wise About Bee and Wasp Stings. Warm sunshine and blossoming flowers are natural invitations to go outside this spring. But as you spend more time outdoors, remember that bees, wasps, and hornets are busy foraging for food and nectar. The seasonal increase in these populations boosts your risk for accidental encounters and stings. Bees, wasps, and hornets inject venom when they sting. The venom contains proteins that poke holes in cells and cause additional damage to them. You feel that immediately as pain and itching, which are triggered as part of a natural process that walls off the venom to keep it from spreading. The venom also activates mast cells that cause additional swelling and redness. The mast cells dump enzymes into the area to degrade the dangerous venom proteins and protect us from their toxic effects, says Dr. Caroline Sokol, an allergist at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital. In most people, over the next several days after a sting, the venom is broken down and the body begins repairing the tissue damage. Swelling and redness last for a day or so. In some people, the sting can trigger one of two types of allergic reactions. A non-life-threatening reaction produces long-lasting symptoms at the sting site. It can be quite dramatic, with a lot of swelling and redness that stick around for a day to a week. The cells continue to be activated and try to promote further activation because the body senses danger. We don't know why. A life-threatening reaction to a sting called anaphylaxis affects the whole body. It involves several body systems at the same time. For example, you might get hives on your skin, an asthma attack in your lungs, severe swelling in your windpipe that blocks oxygen, and a sudden drop in blood pressure. Pay close attention to the way your body responds if you have the unfortunate experience of being stung. If you develop diffuse hives or shortness of breath, it could be anaphylaxis. Call 911, and if you have it handy, give yourself an injection of epinephrine from an auto-injector like the EpiPen. That's E-P-I-P-E-N. It's the best and only antidote, Dr. Sokol says. Epinephrine activates the sympathetic nervous system, and this counteracts a lot of the symptoms. For example, by opening the lungs, raising the blood pressure, or getting rid of hives. In most cases, though, you'll just need to treat the pain and swelling. Dr. Sokol recommends using a cold pack for swelling, applying over-the-counter hydrocortisone cream to the site to relieve itching and swelling, and taking an antihistamine like Allegra, Claritin, or Zyrtec to ease the itching. Call your doctor if you have swelling that doesn't go away after a few days, or a red line on the skin that extends from the sting site toward your heart. Check your home first aid kit to make sure you have antihistamines and cortisone cream on hand in case of a sting. You don't need to get an EpiPen unless you know you're at risk for an allergic reaction to stings. The red flag for risk is a previous allergic reaction, like hives or anaphylaxis, to any stinging insect. In that case, carry two EpiPens wherever you go. You might need a second dose based on your weight for how long the effects of the venom last, Dr. Sokol says. Outside, it's always a good idea to wear sunscreen, a hat, long sleeves, and pants to protect your skin from the sun's powerful ultraviolet rays. These tactics will also help protect you in bee, wasp, or hornet encounters. You might also avoid wearing brightly colored clothes, which can attract the bugs. And if you have a history of anaphylaxis, consider getting a series of allergy shots that reduce your risk for anaphylactic reaction to stings. Medicare pays for the shots. They won't prevent all symptoms of a sting, but they will protect you against anaphylaxis, Dr. Sokol says. Do what you can to protect yourself. Now I'm going to switch to the news brief section of the Harvard Health Letter. And the first short article is entitled, Pets May Help Fend Off Cognitive Decline in Single Seniors. If you live alone, having a furry four-legged companion may help to slow some measures of cognitive decline, new research suggests. The study focused on 7,900 people, average age 66, living in the United Kingdom from 2010 to 2019. Researchers tested the participants' verbal memory, verbal fluency, and verbal cognition. All are key indicators of cognitive health over time. They also compared the test results based on the participants' living situation. About 35% owned pets, and 27% lived alone. People who lived alone and had pets showed slower rates of decline on the test compared with people who lived alone without any pets. In fact, pet owners who lived alone had results equivalent to those of people who live with other people. Living with a dog or cat may help ease loneliness, an important risk factor for cognitive decline, the study authors say. The study was published in the December 2023 issue of JAMA Network Open. Colon cancer risks are higher in people with diabetes. We've long known that routine colonoscopy screenings can save lives, but it's especially important not to skip the test if you have diabetes. The study indicated that people with diabetes have a 47% greater risk of developing colorectal cancer compared with people without diabetes. Published in the November 2023 issue of JAMA Network Open, the study analyzed data for about 55,000 people from 12 southeastern states who contributed at least 2 years of health information between 2002 and 2009. Participants indicated whether they had diabetes. Using follow-up surveys, researchers tracked participants until 2018. People with diabetes were twice as likely as those without the condition to develop colorectal cancer if they hadn't undergone colonoscopy screening, and were at even greater risk if they had ever smoked. Additionally, those diagnosed with diabetes within the previous 5 years had the greatest colorectal cancer risk. While current guidelines recommend that people at average risk of colorectal cancer start screenings at age 45, the study's findings suggest that routine screening might begin at an earlier age in some people with diabetes. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.